Hello, this is Rob from the future. If you have a fast forward button, you should probably just click that sucker, because otherwise I'm about to waste 13 minutes of your time. Easily waste 12 minutes of your time. Push it. Push that button right now. Why are you still here? You should click it. You need to fast forward. If you click it twice, you might even miss the ad. I'm sure you've heard the ad by now. It's me talking up the Anchor podcast platform. They've been nice to me. I don't necessarily want more podcasts to compete with. Are you really still here? Just push fast forward. Do it now.
Fast forward. This place is dangerous.
All right, this is the normal dumb mic check. Like, it's weird because I feel like I should tell you guys that the open mic, this podcast, it pretty much exists to convince me to write more, to kind of give me something like motivation or whatever. So it's, I don't know, is it ironic? I feel like I'm the one that should know if this is an ironic thing. Looking at a little sparrow singing outside my window. I mean, outside the window here in this cafe behind me. All right, so here's the thing that may be ironic. Don't ask Alanis Morissette. I have a feeling she doesn't know. But I made the podcast to convince me to do writing, and now I'm ahead of schedule on the writing, but the podcast is behind schedule because I normally record these on Monday, and right now it's like 1 o'clock on Wednesday, so. In about 6 hours, this will go live. And normally, I have like 2 days. And the reason for that is mainly, obviously, it's a buffer so that I can, you know, if I have people who promise to be on, or if I, you know, get sick or something. But this week, I haven't been sick or anything. I could have just as easily recorded this on Monday, and part of the reason I record on Monday is that thing where Adelaide interferes and tries to lick my face, or you hear her shake. That's like, I like that. Whenever I re-listen to old episodes, and I'm pretty much the only one who listens to these, but whenever I listen to old episodes and I hear the little artifacts of Adelaide in the background, or me being interfered because she tries to lick my nose or whatever, it just makes me feel all warm and fuzzy. But I don't know, probably unprofessional. But then the podcast is kind of intentionally amateurish. Not that I could do better. Not that I could do better if I were given a bunch of professional equipment and advice and editors or whatever. Alright, so, let me see. Oh, there's this New Jersey podcast thing. I'm gonna put a link to it, maybe, if I remember. I'm gonna put a link in the show notes for this episode. I don't know. Do you guys think this is a fiction podcast? I mean, especially when I don't, other than me and Jennifer, I don't have that many people submitting. And I pretty much only read fiction. I read a bunch of poetry, which is, I don't know, flip a coin whether that's fiction or something. And is her comedy fiction? What's the argument? But a great deal of the stuff, especially I've been reading from Macmillan, a great deal of the stuff I do is fiction. Anyway, this was a mic check. I'm going to listen to this and you guys can have it. I suggest fast-forwarding. You're only here to hear Jennifer, and I've already got her recording from, like, last week, because she's always, always ahead of schedule. Unlike me, who, I swear to God, I cannot be trusted. All right, what else? Oh, I feel like, since there's a newsletter and I talk about the podcast in the newsletter, maybe I should talk about the newsletter in the podcast. So the podcast doesn't have a newsletter. The the collection of books, or me as a fiction writer has a newsletter. Maybe I have a newsletter. And so, in the last episode and this episode, I'll put the link in the show notes. Feel free to sign up. I try to send the newsletter out on Sunday at midnight. That is to say Monday at midnight, because it's 12 a.m. Monday. This week it was also late. Everything was late that wasn't me writing. I really did write a ridiculous amount of chapter 9. In fact, it's probably... Oh no, it's not quite done. It's about halfway, now that I think about it. On the other hand, the stuff I have written that's calling itself chapter 9 in my little notebook, fat leather notebook, the stuff that I have, some of it doesn't even belong in the Macmillan novel, because it's the narrator's backstory / history, and some of it shouldn't even exist until maybe around chapter 11, because it has more to do with the central premise of the Macmillan narrative. So I don't know where that'll go, because I don't know how to explain this, because different writers will say different things about their stuff. But imagine you know a story, like you've been told a story. No, better yet, you were a witness. You were there and you saw it. And then you sometimes think about it. Okay. And so then a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of years later, you decide to write down what happened. And there's going to be a lot of irrelevant details, like what color people's shirts were, or what people were talking about before or after. And even in a lot of cases, what people's names are. So let's say the event was that some innocent party was focused on by, you know, inappropriately in a bookstore, and that person was taken aside by security, completely irrational. That person, they didn't do anything wrong, so they completely didn't know what was going on. So that person is taken aside, and then that person doesn't know what's going on, so they reject the whole notion of being taken aside when they were just looking at books or whatever. And the next thing you know, that person's outside with the security, and the police have been called, and the police are driving up with guns pulled, and even while the car is moving. Now, those are bare facts, and I mean, it didn't take me very long to just tell you that. And this is a true story, and I was there because that was me. But if I were to relay that as a fictional story, I mean, I could throw in whatever I like. I could make the cop a racist. I could make the security guy a bully who just likes having power. He did threaten to spray me with pepper spray. He literally said, "Calm down or I'll calm you down." This is when he's accusing me of something. I don't even know what he's accusing me of. And he's taken me out of the store as if I've committed some kind of crime. You know, fuck these people. Fuck mall security in general. And just everybody who can just use their position to push around people who haven't done anything and they're just minding their own fucking business. Fuck all those people, top to bottom. Whether they're the president or whether they're the fucking ADP security dickheads. Sorry, ADP, I'm sure you're fine. Please just ignore the rant. You're the only security name I could think of. All right. But anyway, back to the fiction thing. So in the Yellow Book, the Dismin novel, so let's say I know this story because it's in my head, whatever. And it really wouldn't take that long to tell the story, but maybe I want to actually entertain people, and maybe I want to make people kind of smile a little, like, oh, I recognize that. So, you know, someone's going to die in, like, the next scene, so maybe I make that person put on a red shirt. And, you know, maybe it doesn't matter if there's a whole other species of intelligent, you know, humanoid people. So what if we made a whole other species of intelligent humanoid people? And for that matter, what if we just threw the whole story half billion years in the future? There are things that can be done with that. Like in my case, I can ignore reality and kind of make the world, but I can keep the parts of reality that I like, and anything that changes, I can be like, well, half a billion years, a lot happened. And anything that doesn't change, that should have changed, I can be like, well, half a billion years, like, for example, the moon's getting farther from the Earth, maybe the moon didn't get farther from the Earth because I made a typo, more or less. I can be like, oh, well, superior intelligent beings came along and corrected the orbit, you know, kind of like Doctor Who might use that kind of argument. I don't know why I'm going through all this now. I don't remember what the point was. Maybe the point was that sometimes the fiction is longer. You know what? I don't remember the point. This was a mic check. What am I even doing? Why is it 10 minutes? Anyway, if you guys think this is a fiction podcast, let me know on my Twitter. It's Cormorant Hobo. I'll be back in a few minutes. There'll be an ad. Oh, you know what we should do first is have the goats, tons of goats. I'm just going to put on a bunch of goats. Goat, 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 and goat. And then, Morrency can introduce us. And then there'll be an ad. And then there'll be the announced noise, the dun, 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 whatever. And then it'll be another Morrency. So her little snip, her little comedy. That way you guys can just turn it off because I know what you're really here for. Okay, so let's see. Mic check, Morrency's announcement, ad. We have the one. And then the little announce noise, and then Jennifer's WTF comedy clip. And then I'll read chapter 8 from Macmillan the Magician, which will be pretty much what we do this St. Paddy's Day. All right. Well, I hope you guys are good and drunk. It should be around 7 when you hear this. All right. Oh, let me see. Enjoy the ad. Enjoy Morrency. Enjoy my book. And, I forgot what the point was, so I wasted 10 minutes of your life for no reason. Okay. Ciao. Oh, wait. I should get a coffee and a peanut butter square. Quarter. I haven't really talked about Jill in the last few episodes. Yeah, she's fine. Look at her. Look at her over there. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Just stand there. Be hot. I mean, in the body shape sense and not in the, you know, malfunctioning espresso machine sense. All right. 12 minutes of your life you'll never get back.
From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morrency of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe, with your master of ceremonies and master of debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a... This is Jennifer Morrency. Welcome to this week's episode of WTF, the show that tries to answer its own question. As Frank Costanza might say, I have a lot of opinions, and now you're going to hear about it. So nowadays everybody with any job whatsoever is a freaking essential worker. I just saw an article on Newsweek, where they claim librarians are essential workers. When's the last time anybody actually went to the library to check out a physical book? At this point, librarians, little league coaches, nightclub comedians, bartenders, the people who take your ticket in a movie theater, and cruise ship stewards are all going to get vaccinated before chronically ill patients. I thought essential workers were supposed to be those who maintain critical infrastructure like utilities and transportation, not movie theaters and nightclubs, unless reopening the tourist economy is more important than saving human lives. And there's the answer, the economy is more important than you or me. So how about those vaccines? The government says their highest priority is to give them to poor people, and yet all the vaccine sites around here are drive-through only, and they're located in the most affluent suburbs. Most poor people I know around here use public transportation and can't get to the vaccine sites. Then the government wonders why poor people aren't being vaccinated, and the mainstream media floats these ridiculous theories that poor people are afraid of getting the vaccine. So we have government health officials looking through all the finest country clubs and golf courses and seafood stores trying to find poor people buying crab legs with an EBT card, but they're not finding anyone. Then they say, well, there's no poor people around here. Obviously, they're afraid of the vaccine because they're dumb. If the state or the county really wanted to vaccinate low-income people, they'd be setting up vaccine sites at dollar stores, public transit terminals, and residential motels. The fact that they don't shows you what the government really thinks about low-income people. And how about those dollar stores anyway? It's almost like our local dollar store is trying to kill us. The store is poorly ventilated anyhow, but for the last few months they've been offering one-day-only sales. Basically, it's one day a week when the whole low-income population of the neighborhood tries to cram into the little tiny dollar store, pushing and shoving through the narrow aisles. I call them super spreader sale days. I don't go because I'm immunocompromised, and saving $5 isn't worth costing my life. Thank you all for being such a great audience. If you want to help me buy a meal at the dollar store on a non-sale day, my donation link is v.gd/jenmor. My Twitter is at Jennifer Morency with an I.
Okay, so I hear those when you hear them. Okay, that's not quite true, but I definitely try to wait until when I'm making the podcast. I don't know if Jennifer listens to these on a regular basis, but if she does, sorry, Jen. Sometimes I listen when I download it if you say something to me that piques my interest, or if I'm just, I don't know, otherwise bored. In this case, I didn't listen until just now. So, and I took notes. I took notes so I can talk about how, let's see, Frank Costanza says he has opinions and you're going to hear them. I kind of expected a longer Seinfeld reference, but apparently that was that. It's good. I kind of wonder if you're a fan of Seinfeld. I'm a fan. So I feel like I meet people who don't like Seinfeld and I just scratch my head because I'm uncomfortable around Martians. I don't really know how to react. But for what it's worth, I used to check books out from my library, and then the library fucking closed because of the fucking virus. So if a librarian is an essential worker, go fuck yourself. Go fuck yourself, whoever made that distinction. You fucking closed my fucking library, you son of a bitch. Also, Little League coaches, fuck you. You're not essential workers, not even remotely. Cruise ship stewards, I'm sorry, even without the current pandemic, a cruise ship is... You're probably going to get the plague anyway. And that's... This is coming from a person who's a fan of cruise ships. Let's see, she had a long section toward the middle there where she talked about government incompetence. Yeah, I really don't understand this thing where the media or government officials, elected officials, politicians... They'll talk about race, they'll talk about all kinds of things, but they completely ignore that the problem seems to be that some people are just, like, chronically poor. And they just, I guess we like to blame them for their own. It's like if a smoker gets lung cancer, or if a lung cancer person is found out to have been a smoker, or emphysema, and you find out they were a smoker. So, in general, if people are talking about poor people, unless they're being, you know, completely sympathetic and almost over-the-top sympathetic, they're probably blaming them for their situation. And even poor people, even people like me, I blame myself for my situation all the time. Alright, my thing talking about your thing is going to be longer than your thing. Let's see. Oh, she talked about how, yeah, they think the economy is more important than your life. I don't know how honest this argument is, how, I don't know if they're saying this, you know, with sincerity, but the argument they seem to use is that if the economy slumps, that the people will die from the economy slumping somehow. Because, well, I mean, you know, if we fire a bunch of people, they become poor, and then their situation is like mine, and then I guess they don't know how to find fucking county services department, and then they just, you know, die in the street. Let me see. What it is it's fear. So people who, they're poor, but they're not quite homeless, and they're basically afraid. So people at whatever level, let's say there's a level and we'll give them numbers, like 3. People at level 3 are afraid of becoming level 2, and they, you know, it's like they will aspire to the next level, or they'll get comfortable in their level 3, but they're afraid of level 2, and they're deathly afraid of level 1. And I read a thing once where it says something along the lines of that the peasant doesn't realize that there's a class above the class that's above them. So if you're at level 3 and then you see level 4, those people might seem like they're rich to you, but you don't realize that the people at level 4 are jealous of the people at level 5. From the perspective of the level 3 person, 4 and above are all the same class. They're all royalty, I guess. I probably fucked up paraphrasing the thing. Let's see, super spreader sale days. Yeah, I like dollar store. I was at a Dollar Tree the other day. I got orange juice, and let's see, what else did I get? Oh, I got a big bag. I got like 5 of those little top ramen noodle things, and probably a bunch of candy, knowing me. I can't remember. Oh, and a can and a bottle of soda, because one was bigger, but it was just Pepsi, and the other was smaller, but it was cherry Pepsi. You see how that is. La la la. Okay, we should have the vaccines at the dollar stores. Yeah, we probably should. Yeah, alright. Well, mainly I was gonna record this just to say, thank you, Jennifer Morency, for the WTF segment. Since nobody else submits, so this is like 6 minutes of it's like I dedicated 6 minutes to Jennifer's section. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed her thing. My thing, I'm just talking about her thing. All right. Hello, welcome to... Oh, you've already heard all this? I'm going to do it anyway. Hello, I'm R. Wesley Edwards, a.k.a. Common Cormorant, although everywhere but freaking Twitter. Welcome to the Cormorant Cafe. This is Wednesday, so in spite of it also being St. Patrick's Day, it is open mic night. I'm just going to read a bunch of lesbian poetry, obviously. Lesbian. Classic. Quote-unquote. They say classic, but yeah, just throw that word around. I don't see where you got that. And if you're going to call it lesbian poetry, you probably don't need to call it lesbian love poetry, because lesbian implies the relationship. So you don't need the word love. Right? Okay. So it's just lesbian poetry. But it's classic lesbian love poetry. It's the key to everything. That's the name of the book. Presumably, lesbian love poetry is the key to everything, hence the title of the book, but take that as you like. So I'll read that. I'll read a few of those. And I'm also going to read chapter 8 from Macmillan the Magician. And I feel like I should apologize in advance, for the overlap from last week. But there have been a few changes. And maybe people would just skip last week because it's only parts 1 and 2, and this is the whole chapter 8. Or maybe you guys are just binging all from episode 9 down the line to this episode, in which case, I guess you can just skip it. Just exit now. Quit. Jump to the next podcast. Whatever your cue is. Go meditate. I don't know. Whatever you like. Oh no, wait, don't do that. You're gonna have to figure out a way to skip parts 1 and 2, but I presume you came for the lesbian love poetry, obviously, and yeah, you probably want the other parts of chapter 8. And keep in mind, these are all, no, this is pretty well edited by me, but it still needs to be seen by people who aren't me, because the mistakes you make as a writer are going to be the same mistakes, not all, but some of the same mistakes you'll also make as an editor. Like, I might not be able to notice my own mistakes, that kind of thing. Ugh, all right. Anyway, so yeah, this part, since nobody submits and all the people who wanted to listen to Jennifer Morency have already exited the podcast, this is just for people who fidget with their pens. No, this is just for people who have come to listen to either lesbian love poetry from The Key to Everything, which, oh my god, what did I do with that book? It just occurred to me that I can't actually read it if I can't. Oh, here it is. Okay. So I will explain to you guys what the cover looks like. But what I should do is just put a link to the Amazon so you guys can all buy your own copy so you can read along. I always say what page. All right. Well, as I said, this whole last section is just for people who like amateur podcast MC people, whatever the hell I am, and the people who have been following along in the Macmillan novel, Macmillan the Magician, or maybe the people from the future who have found the podcast because somehow I became rich with my Archangel Valley series. Hello, people. I probably have a heart attack and die and don't get to actually enjoy the success. Or a brain tumor or something. Alright, I'm not sure if I'm crossing my fingers for the death or for the success. Oh, did I mention Happy St. Patrick's Day? I have a bracelet that I've been wearing since last St. Patrick's Day that says, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." And just to call back for Jennifer, I got it from a dollar store. They had a bunch of them. They came as a big bundle. There's Kiss Me, I'm Irish, and a few others. Anyway. And let me see. All right, well, enjoy the weird overlap of parts 1 and 2 again. And there'll probably be a bunch of these lesbian love poems. I will just try to pick them at random and hopefully not accidentally reread some of the ones I've read already. The book isn't really that big. So it is a real problem, a real possibility. All right, making this exactly 5 minutes. Can you hear me? Is this thing on? Jump to page 38 in your hymnals, my parishioners. That's where we're reading from. Hey, so, can you hear that? Background music. I put background music. It says Molly Molly. I don't know. It's part of the platform. So I don't even know who to thank for the music, the background music, and the interlude music. Some of the background music is actually me with a little drum pad app from a million years ago. If it's bad, that means it's probably me. All right, this is actually literally called The Key to Everything, so expect this poem to get read if they ever... If I and Jennifer, if I ever get my acting in gear to do the bonus episode, The Key to Everything bonus episode, we'll probably read this early on, maybe at the end, I don't know. But it'll definitely get repeated because it's literally called The Key to Everything, which might be the key to why the book is called The Key to Everything. It says it's written by Mae Swenson. I expect to be sued for excerpting these. All right, Mae Swenson, the key to everything. Is there anything I can do, or has everything been done? Or do you prefer someone else to do it? Or don't you trust me to do it right? Or is it hopeless and no one can do a thing? Or do you suppose I don't really want to do it and I'm just saying that? Or don't you hear me at all? Or what? You're waiting for the right person, the doctor or the nurse, the father or the mother, or the person with the name you keep mumbling in your sleep that no one ever heard of. There's no one named that really, except yourself, maybe. If I knew what your name was, I'd prove it's your own name spelled backward or twisted in some way, the one you keep mumbling. But you won't tell me your name, or don't you know it yourself? That's it, of course. You've forgotten, or never quite knew it, or weren't willing to believe it. Then there is something I can do. I can find your name for you. That's the key to everything. Once you'd repeat it clearly, you'd come awake, you'd get up and walk, knowing where you're going, where you came from, and you'd love me after that. Or would you hate me? No, once you'd get there, you'd remember and love me, of course. I'd be gone by then. I'd be far away. Okay, I feel like I should tell you guys that the way these things are formatted makes it really difficult to read it in any kind of coherent way. Like, I don't know if I'm supposed to pause when the person puts a new line in, and if I do, it sounds... I don't know. Maybe it just flows better, but I'm overthinking it and I kind of ruin it by trying to make it. All right, well, whatever. All right, well, the next thing we're going to read is going to be something I wrote, and it's from the novel Macmillan, The Magician. But I'm going to upload this one first. Hope you guys went to page 38 in your little hymnals. Okay, well, now we're just gonna read our, we're gonna read from Macmillan the Magician. This is chapter 8. A real quick recap on chapter 7. Some weird little alien tortured a native woman. Eventually, Macmillan killed him. All right. Now, chapter 8. And let me see. It's chapter 8's super title is chapter 7, part 2. Chapter 8's title is The Angel and the Vampire. And the first part, section 1, whatever part 1, is called West Covina again. Alright, here we go. Chapter 8. Part 1. West Covina. Again. Now, I've mentioned the narrator has her little marginalia, her little notes in the thing. She says, I had to get involved directly again. My agent was otherwise occupied. My contemporary agent, too, as he shadowed my father and uncle and their friend, who'd been my lover, but they're mentally... Okay, so her contemporary agent has shadowed the three characters from the other book on their mentally unhinged mission, she says. But that's another story, and you can read about it. You can read it if you want, maybe. Okay, that ends her note. She says, all right, so this is normal text. I just returned from a visit to the Great Shrine. See, I can be sentimental too. And my goblins were frightfully freaking out in their enclosure. even upsetting a few of the younger, though usually unflappable gremlings, which were squawking and trembling and even throwing themselves at the bars of their cages as if to break free. The camp was otherwise undisturbed. I rubbed the back of my neck momentarily, then saw and heard the klaxons and flashing lights. With a flick of my wrist and a sigh, these alarms were quieted. And so, after a moment or two, were my pets. One of the gremlings had severely injured its arm, and another had given itself a scalp laceration and showed signs of concussion. I endeavored to calm my charges. When all the creatures were finally calm and healed, I removed a painted monkey from under a wrist scale and touched it to the corresponding hyperviewer, which made a chime which I, to be quite honest, did not expect. I ran into my cabin and dressed for 1886. I reviewed the overwhelming and overlapping announcements. So there was another foreign creature was spotted near the old surveillance station. She puts the number 2. She really wants to make sure that we don't mistake it for the surveillance station that they took apart. Okay, another foreign creature was spotted near the old surveillance station from long ago. For me at least, from the long ago days of that little blue motherfucker. I sighed. This was going to be one of those days. I decided on weapons and armor. The guy was apparently on some kind of reconnaissance, but there were no pictures. She laments that the amount of power it would require to submit such things could not be easily concealed. Plain but encoded text was all I had to go on for now. My uncle had been experimenting with a lindworm, and he'd gifted me one of his more compact prototypes, about the size of a child's fist. This I affixed to the middle of my upper back using crisscross straps of strong goblin hide. The newcomer had, I read as I munched grubs and kale salad, come from the direction of the Imp's false stop or pilotless station, so I'd be heading to West Covina again. I needed time. So I sent 3 hyperpackets with instruction code intended to immediately deactivate the station. I was heading further back, but it gets tricky. You can't cross or overlap with your own self, and the station counts because if it detects me, and it would detect me, then it may send that information in the very news briefs I'm reading right now, and kids, that's a paradox. I could not risk Butch's machines sending us reports in our pasts about our futures. I decided I need a few days at least, shook my grandfather's hourglass accordingly, and activated a vortex. There's a part break. So, round about the end of spring, 1886, I myself appeared in sparkling scarlet within view of Frankie's unmanned stop. Frankie, you'll remember, was the nickname that those guys had for that imp alien creature. Within view of Frankie's so-called unmanned stop, she puts it in quotes, the vortex shimmered behind me and I deactivated all transmitting radios and sat on the ground. Thinking I was early, I opened a Coke and began looking around for ideas about camping for a day or two, when a shuttle nearly twice the size of Merlin's escape pod, she puts number 2 in parentheses, as though we're going to forget, or as if it's relevant. Okay, so this is me talking. Side note, I personally am amused by the antics and style of the narrator. Okay. Now that is out of the way. Okay. A shuttle nearly twice the size of Merlin's escape pod number 2 came in for a landing. She puts an exclamation mark in parentheses. What the fuck? She exclamation mark, question mark. Oh. See, this is why we edit things. Jesus Christ, what the hell is going on here? Oh, it's goblin hide. It gets tricky. Activated a vortex. Okay, so see, this was an error that was introduced in the editing. She wants to say I bleated, B-L-E-A-T-E-D, bleated like a sheep. The fucking thing changed it to belated, so it didn't make sense, and then I had to fix it, and now you guys are stuck, wasting your time listening to me. All right. A shuttle nearly twice the size of Merlin's escape pod number 2 came in for a landing! Exclamation mark. What the fuck? I bleated. This means he's early, if you haven't noticed. She put that in parentheses, although that should probably be one of those little marginalia notes. See? You guys get to see the editing process in C2. She says, I made myself invisible and drank my soda and watched in fascination. I checked and double-checked my chronograph. Yep, 1886, atmospheric radiation test confirmed. They're just gonna blithely land and... She put dot, dot, dot. A lone man, covered head to toe in astonishingly beautiful tech armor, emerged from the craft. It, the armor, was of a kind of dusky orange with matte black trim. I loved him. It was beautiful. I caught myself biting my own lip. Again, for some reason, we've introduced a problem in editing. It changed it to hitting, even though I know it's biting. Because I've read it a few times, because that's what you do when you edit. Something where these errors get introduced during editing. One of the most common errors that gets introduced during editing, especially in a compound, like a longer sentence, is that the sentence itself no longer makes sense. It's like it's grammatically incorrect. Because you moved something around and you broke it. All right, anyway. He was taller than the imp creature and humanoid, though I couldn't tell as yet if it was a primate or something else. He or she or it retrieved a large shroud or tarpaulin from his shuttle, which he shook and then used carefully, almost patiently, to cover the vehicle. The effect was immediate. The shroud and vehicle vanished. With notions of approaching for a closer look, I stood. But if this entity has cloaking abilities, holy shit! What the hell happened to this thing? It was much further along. I seem to have broken it by editing it. He likely also... I need a verb here. Has. Alright, there we go. With notions of approaching for a closer look, I stood. But if this entity has cloaking abilities, he likely also has anti-stealth tech. So... if he can make himself invisible, he might also be able to see an invisible, this narrator woman. All right. So she says, all right, back to the text. She says, from a belt about his hips, he unclipped a metallic looking device with some of the same matte black versus dusky orange ornamentation, which he held up in front of his eyes as though looking through it. He was still. He swept his arms, rotating the machine, and then his whole body too, and, as I knew he would, he headed in the direction of the imp's hidden structure and underground lair. Although, the chance it was a coincidence and he was heading for the trees and the possibility of water was not, of course, ruled out. But two, it was also possible he detected the bird hide in our surveillance equipment. I shadowed him as quietly as possible as he ventured forth. He unfastened and removed orange and black gloves, then helmet. He looked like a Mark I human being. And an excellent specimen he was, too. He had an uncontrollable head of dishwater blonde hair, strong cheekbones above an adequate chin, beautiful, biteable lips, deep, soulful eyes. I licked my lips, wishing the motion would allow me to smell him, but lo, I was too far away. For now. What would be wrong with the direct approach? I could just become visible, catch up with him, and hey, George. My mind was filled with this and other more prosaic fantasies, and I watched and I followed. The transmitting muted, as I've said, I was still able to receive, and as we rapidly approached the scene of so much drama and waiting and dismay, Surveillance Station 2's work came flooding through. The alien, but not an alien, would no doubt discover my bird hide. Rather than panic, which is the appropriate response to this impending emergency scenario, I had quick, breathless fantasies of being inside and nude, but restless when this happened. I missed Ralph, perhaps? After Merlin bolted, throwing off his backpack and baiting the imp to his demise, I had not been back. Neither of us had. that is neither my agent nor I. And in this instance, it was good we detected this human. However, strictly speaking, it violated protocol, and as we'll soon see, this lapse in judgment left us open to detection. At any rate, I was not prepared for what we, the human shuttle pilot and I, found. Merlin had most thoroughly excavated the imp's lair. All that remained was a large crater. It was a giant hole which met us, though the human did find some of the imp's long sticks rubbed of their hatchet spear ends, and, luck for him, but not me, one of Merlin's sonar cylinders. Now she has one of her notes. Fuck, Grandpa, what the hell? I didn't know my surveillance station, she puts two in parentheses. Oh, she says, if I didn't know my surveillance station, too, was there, perhaps I wouldn't think this, but the human newcomer appeared to be intentionally ignoring the bird hide. Now one of her notes. I, of course, strove to avoid being detected by my own equipment while observing the above. The man from the shuttle held his machine up again. He swept the area and managed to find one of the blue steel ladder rungs, and she's going to close off this section with one of her notes, and it says, is Merlin intentionally leaving shit behind now? Should I throw my cherry Coke can into the giant pit and shrug and walk away? Oh, wow. 13 minutes. All right. Okay, parishioners, let's go back to the Key to Everything hymnal. Where the hell did my hymnal go? Oh, here it is. I was thinking we should go to page 36. Okay, page 36 in the Key to Everything classic lesbian love poems. Here we go. It says, I don't know who wrote this one, though. It's weird. It says it's translated by Ellen S. Trueblood. What a cool name, Trueblood. I gotta change my name. My name is so boring. I want to be Alan S. Trueblood. I would just be one name. Just be Trueblood. I think people would just accuse me of being a white supremacist. I want to put like a... Is it considered racist if I get a brown pride tattoo? Maybe a peach pride. Kind of a freckled pink pride. Anyway, okay, so page 36 in the hymnal, Key to Everything. This one's called Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And that's where the Spanish ends. Oh, because it's translated from Spanish, presumably Spanish. Looks like Spanish. I suppose that it's possible that it's maybe Portuguese, but I'm pretty sure it's Spanish. Anyway, it could be Latin. It could be Italian. I guess that a bunch of these languages are close to each other. Kind of like cousins. They're buddies. They're good. They're cousins that live nearby. Okay, alright, so page 36. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, translated by Ellen S. Trueblood. Here we go. My divine Lysis, do forgive my darling, if so I address you, unworthy though I am to be known as yours. I cannot think it bold to call you so, well knowing you've ample thunderbolts to shadow any overweening of mine. It's the tongue that misspeaks. When what is called dominion, I mean the master's rule, is made to seem possession by the slave, the vassal says, my king, my prison, the convict says, and any humble slave will call the master his without offense. Thus, when I call you mine, It's not that I expect you'll be considered such, only that I hope I may be yours. I saw you, need more be said? To broadcast a fire, telling the cause suffices. No need to apportion blame for the effect. Seeing you so exalted does not prevent, my darling. No god is ever secure against the lofty flight of human thought. There are women more deserving, yet in distance from heaven, the humblest of valleys seems no further than the highest peak. In sum, I must admit to the crime of adoring you. Should you wish to punish me, the very punishment will be reward. Oh. Probably sounds much better in Spanish, to be sure. All right. Let's see. I guess we'll get back to Macmillan. So now we're going to be, what, chapter 8? Whatever, part 2, I guess. I feel like now is a good time to mention that this is a sneak peek, and this hasn't actually been edited by anyone who isn't me, and some of these things will be changed, especially the titles, and the titles will just... Sadly, the titles are the thing that gets... No, that's not really sad. There's nothing really sad about it. The editing process, the thing that's sad about the editing process is that it takes a long time and you need people who aren't you. And it's tricky because they have to be competent as editors. So they have to be able to see, you know, punctuation, spelling, whatever errors. But they also have to be kind of sympathetic to the narrative or to the author. So like they can't... You'll see people complaining that their editor's basically a check on their style, and that the editor or the copy editor pisses on their work. And I've seen it, so I know it's a thing. And it's like I said, it's tricky. You have to find people who won't do that out of respect for the work, for the writer, for whatever the theme. I don't know. Alright, so part 2 of Macmillan the Magician, chapter 8, is called Angel, and here we go. The newcomer spent several hours combing over what I'd have taken for a meteor impact or crash site, and then, though I was invisible and hidden in the trees, and far behind him, to my fright and utter amazement, turned on his heel and began walking toward me. I'd been crouching, but... Here, now, I stood up, but otherwise chanced to remain hidden and invisible. At less than 2 meters distance, he halted and greeted me in American English. Hi, Andromedan lady. I'm Blake. He transferred his gizmo from right to left hand and stuck his right hand out in the handshake gesture. Blake waited patiently. After a minute or two of this impasse, he said, Look, I waited until your surveillance equipment powered down and went silent. Now, if you'd be so kind, I have questions. His eyes weren't focused on me, so he couldn't, after all, actually see me. I made myself visible and stepped into view. Tisman, I said, and took his bare hand in my gloved one. You're blue, Blake observed. My grandfather, it's a long story, I said, suddenly flustered. How can I help you? He hesitated, wasn't aware your people were so tall. My father preferred tall women. She has a note that says, what is wrong with me? Blake, apparently realizing something of some urgency, pulled an orange and black handkerchief from a hip pocket, which he quickly began wrapping around the front of his face below his eyes. He tied this mask behind his head and adjusted it under his chin, but whatever it was he was doing, it was too late. You smell so, he started, and fell into my lustful arms. The mask, which came off again easily, had the faint aroma of iguana urine. I placed it into one of my own hip pockets for later examination. I removed his armor as he removed mine. We removed each other's clothing in a whirlwind and a frenzy. I'd assumed he saw me for what I am, but in truth, I'd no idea what he saw when he looked at me. As he spoke of the Argria, I don't know how to pronounce it, the silver nitrate poisoning that made them turn blue. The Argria, and my height, after all. But now, as we licked and bit each other in a sea of our clothing and armor, he was giving my chest a good deal of attention, which would have made more sense were I a human woman. I admit I was slightly disappointed, but I allowed him, for the moment, to have his delusions. She says, I ran my fingers, all spikes and claws and scales, through his mess of thick head hair and allowed myself to fall into our lovemaking. He kissed and nibbled ferociously, even for a young human male, and when the time came, and it took little enough time indeed, I was rather pleased with things. I allowed Blake his pleasures. He was insatiable. Now, she has a side note. But then I was in physical contact with him, and that, as you know, of course, kept up his youthful vim and vigor. That ends her note. Eventually, as hours passed with the sun... Oh, I don't understand how these errors get introduced or where... I think... Why? And? What in the hell happened? How did that even happen? Okay, sorry, you guys. She says, I allowed Blake his pleasures. He was insatiable. And she says the thing about how she, you know, basically rejuvenates him by virtue of being in physical contact. Okay, the thing that made Macmillan... revive the rancher guy. That's what she's talking about. And she says, eventually, as hours passed and the sun was long set, and I sensed immense areas of bruising up and down my inner thighs, I was forced to gas him so I could sleep. And that's the end of this part. Parishioners, go back to your hymnal, The Key to Everything, classic lesbian love poems, edited by Jerry Gomez Perlberg. I suggest page 34. It's called Poem for Pat from Paula Gunn Allen. And forgive me if I've read this before. Even though I listen to the podcast for quality check and oh, you have no idea how much I love the sound of my own voice. I may not realize that I read it before, because I go through the book all the time, because it's just so wonderful. The hymnal, it's a hymnal. All right, Paula Gunn Allen, two ends that gun. She's not a Second Amendment gun. She's a G-U-N-N gun. Poem for Pat. I wanted you to hear that song, she told me. So I listened and listened, trying to understand why. Even admitting it was lovely, heart-provoking, I still wondered. It took me clean through winter, the past full-bodied trees, into another snow. Well, I'll be damned. Here comes your ghost again. It happened to be on the day we found each other again, she said. We were shivering at what we contemplated, locked together on the sandstone mesa at Star Rock. We were looking everywhere, she said. Dini, Dini, country spread at our feet. We could hear the coy dogs howling far off and watch the chindy dust devils whirl their plans on the floor below. Watch for rain. Our breath comes out white clouds, mingles and hangs in the air. There were cedars twisted near where we sat. It was spring. Today the sun flows softly through my window, and I'm listening to the song, thinking of her again on that mesa, wondering what mystery marginalized out of that wind, and if it rained. Okay, so I tried to read that the way it was formatted. If it sounded weird, I consider myself a poet sometimes, and I don't fucking format things so that if you read it aloud, you sound like a stilted jackass. Just saying. And we are back to Macmillan the Magician, Chapter 8, and I guess we are at Part 3, and now this part, moving on from the earlier, well, side note, I told you, this part will almost definitely lose its title and be called something else, or it may just lose its title completely. Anyway, it's called Disclosures at the moment. Alright, Chapter 8. Part 3. I awoke very early the next morning, finding Blake still sprawled atop me, nude and beautiful as before. I resisted the urge to lick and bite him, but barely. Carefully, I extracted myself and attempted to remove the discarded scales and clean up the bits of shed skin. There was, however, little I could do about all my gelatinous secretions which covered him and the ground. Thankfully, though, our clothes and armors were spared this further indignity. An egg sac was hardening in my abdomen, and I nearly started retching with the pain. I satisfied myself of his slumber by slapping his face a few times, and went into the shadows and cover of the nearby trees. I urinated, which reduced some of the pressure, thus the egg sac dislodged. This was more painful than I remembered, but perhaps I always think that. Swiftly, I dug a shallow hole where the shadows seemed most permanent, and was reaching for the silver nitrate when I realized the canister was no longer strapped on my ankle. Everything's an ordeal, I mumbled, as I so often heard from a similarly flustered butch. I carefully nestled my egg sac in the loamy soil and returned to my sleeping lover and shortly located the canister. With it and a NutriPack, I returned to the hole where I sprayed the eggs thoroughly. I regurgitated something hopefully nutritious, dropped the NutriPack in the hole, and covered everything with loose soil. Outside of a well-equipped 22nd century, at least, fertility laboratory, it would be quite unlikely the eggs could be fertilized by human sperm, but most of the above behavior was instinct anyway. Returning to Blake's sleeping body, I separated our belongings, dressed myself in clothes and armor, and carefully examined his gear. I ate one of my pack meals and thought and dreamed. Eventually he began making sounds, and I returned to him and positioned myself to give him a happy awakening, which he enjoyed. Though I looked through his stuff, I still knew little more than his name, probable species, and the chemical makeup of his semen. There's a part break. We spoke briefly as he was getting dressed, but nothing I remember, nothing consequential. Whatever questions he had for me didn't come up as far as this goes. After, when he was dressed, we walked toward the giant hole Merlin, I presume, had made. strip mining the imps, blue, steel, and other metals and objects. Blake made no pretense of romance. There was no kissing or hands holding, for example, and I followed about half a meter behind, at his elbow, so to speak. At the edge of the wooded area, within sight of Surveillance Station 2, assuming you knew to look, Blake removed the inscrutable device I'd seen him use before from his hip. I, of course, assumed it was used to direct him here and to detect me, and perhaps it had other uses. And perhaps it had other uses. I suspected nothing. And I expected him to hold it up to eye level, as to look at or through it, and so was taken completely by surprise when he ceased walking, turned and whirled around. There was a flash of light and I had an immediate feeling of being tugged. Before I could form a question or even contemplate what had just happened, there, the flash again, and this time I looked down at my abdomen, which had a gray and black mark as though someone had thrown wet dirt at me. And another flash, and I realized the machine was throwing lightning, possibly strong bolts of static electricity. She put an exclamation mark at my body. Possibly strong bolts of static electricity. I should italicize. At my body. Immediately, I squatted and turned and jumped as a flea and landed in a confused jumble onto dirt and river stones, and my entire body was alive with pain, like being crushed, and my eyes blinked rapidly, and my jaw clenched and unclenched, and my body jerked and spasmed. Mercifully, this sensation, this absolute hell, was brief as I lost consciousness within seconds. And that's the end of that part. So you guys should get out your hymnals. And I suggest you turn to page 30. Okay, my blessed parishioners. Alright, we're turning to page 30 in our hymnal. The key to everything. There's going to be two. We're going to read two of them. Page 30 and 31. So, prepare yourself for the beauty of these classic lesbian love poems. First one's from Matilda Betham, which is called A Valentine. On page 30, by the way. What shall I send my sweet today, when all the woods attune in love? And I would show the lark and dove, what I can love as well as they. I'll send a locket full of hair, but no, for it might chance to lie too near her heart, and I should die of love's sweet envy to be there. A violet is sweet to give. Ah, stay, she'd touch it with her lips. And after such complete eclipse, how could my soul consent to live? I'll send a kiss, for that would be the quickest sent, the lightest born. And well I know tomorrow morn she'll send it back to me again. Go, happy winds, ah, do not stay, enamored of my lady's cheek, but hasten home and I'll bespeak your services another day. All right, well. The next one is from Christina Rossetti, and its title is apparently Laura and Lizzie Asleep, and it says it's from something called Goblin Market. Man, if there's a book called Goblin Market filled with lesbian love poetry from someone named Christina Rossetti, can one of you guys mail it to me or something? I don't find it. We'll make a special. Read from that shit too. Alright, anyway, Laura and Lizzie Asleep from Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti on page 31 of our hymnal, The Key to Everything. Golden head by golden head, like two pigeons in one nest, folded in each other's wings, they lay down in their curtailed bed, like two blossoms on one stem, like two flakes of new fallen snow. Like two wands of ivory tipped with gold for awful kings, moon and stars gazed in gazed in at them. Wind sang to them lullaby. Lumbering owls forbore to fly. Not a bat flapped to and fro round their nest. Cheek to cheek and breast to breast, locked together in one nest. Okay, you know what? I really like that one. I think I like that one the best of all of them so far. Yeah, I'm gonna put a special mark on that. See if I can find that other book. All right, back to Macmillan the Magician. I don't even know what part we're on now. 3, 4? We'll see in a minute. And we're back to Macmillan chapter 8. I think this one is part 4. Let me jump over. Alright, part 4, Vampire. Almost certainly this title will not be changed unless the title of the whole chapter changes. Hey, part 4 is called Vampire. Sometime later, and no, I don't know how long, I slowly became aware of my body and noises and the sounds of air being blown and the feeling of inertia. I was aboard his shuttle. I felt like absolute shit, but I was conscious. I opened my eyes a small amount. I was aware of tugging from some thick black cables coming out of my upper arms, inner thighs, armpits, and I suspected under my chin. My wrists were bound behind me, palms together. The bones in my upper arms twisted nearly to the point of breaking with the tension. I remember thinking I was surprised they didn't dislocate. I managed to dip my chin slightly, confirming more black cables, and could see my ankles were also bound with thick cord wrapped innumerable times around and around. I'd been stripped naked except for the thick goblin hide lindworm harness and the silver nitrate canister around my left ankle. It blended with my outer skin and scales, so thankfully wouldn't have been easily detected. But I could see the claws on my feet were roughly clipped or amputated or something, but they were returning. I pressed fingertips into palms and confirmed my talons had also been rudely removed. I couldn't see my wrists, but certainly my emergency beacon and radio transceivers were gone, along with the painted monkeys and darts. Not that I could use them with my hands tied behind me. I felt myself involuntarily struggle against these bonds, and a gasp escaped me. Blake stepped into view. He stood in front of me, standing over my body. He bent slightly at the waist, reached toward my face. He tried to pry one of my eyes open. "Awake, I see," he said. With venom and impatience, the words rolled out of me. "Why have you imprisoned me?" More an accusation of betrayal than a question. More spit than words. More anger than words. I could still feel the shuttle moving and wondered if I'd get any advance notice before we reached the edge of the Mullisundmus. It's Estonian. The word just means bubble's edge. And I ceased to exist. Okay, so I'll just read it. I'll just say bubble's edge. I could still feel the shuttle moving and wondered if I'd get any advance notice before we reached the edge of the bubble. And I ceased to exist in all realities. I regretted nothing. Well, perhaps I couldn't finish these family biographies. And I really wanted to incinerate those eggs. But otherwise, I'd lived a long, long life. Millions of times longer than most of my kind. He was speaking and shaking me out of my thoughts. "I'm harvesting your lymphatic fluid." Blake said this as though casually describing the shapes he perceived in the random gobs made by clouds or milk dropped into coffee. And as though I knew the ramifications, I did not. I'd never been molested in this way, never taken hostage or mistreated in any way. I rubbed a toe against the canister strapped to my ankle, but my claws were still regenerating. Not yet even hard. I made a show of struggling against my bindings. Why are you taking this lymphatic fluid from me? My toenails were almost regenerated. Almost. Don't play dumb, Blake admonished. We know what you are. Those rape pheromones, he spat. He spat it out. He didn't spit. And that the static neutralizer didn't simply cook you and kill you, verified the facts. His fingertips abruptly slapped my mouth and I smell his iguana urine compound again. My tongue briefly escaped my mouth for a taste. Almost. Almost, it says. Almost a toenail clicked against the aerosol canister. Click. Click. I noticed the shine of strange light across my lap and was sure he was at last able to see me for what I am. I mock struggled again as I easily grabbed the silver nitrate canister with my foot. Being unfamiliar with my anatomy, he didn't exactly do a good job with the binding. Probably the canister is empty or nearly empty after the job with the eggs, but it was all I could think of at that moment. I nearly vomited thinking about it now. Those eggs, his fluids. I swallowed. I felt his cables, his limp fluid sucking tubes. I endeavored to keep him talking or otherwise distracted as I flexed my toes, gripping more firmly and flexing my ankles against his bindings. I shook my shoulders painfully as could be, hissed, spat, click, click. Blake shoved me backwards. My shoulders struck and stuck to something hard and cold and viscous behind me. I learned that he, whoever and whatever he is, knows that Andromedans exist. She put it in quotes, because technically I'm not sure this word applies to me, at most half or a quarter, and that we are immortal. He doesn't know that only two of us are quote-unquote available in 1886, and that even if he had access to more, only three of us are immortal. And then she puts click, click. I learned he thinks my lymph fluid would somehow help him and his people to be immortal if they could somehow transplant it into their bodies. She put that last part in italics. And I almost hoped he'd cross out of the bubble and I'd cease to exist, and then but I would be gone and I couldn't see the look on his face or incinerate the eggs, so, and then click. If my immortality is in my lymphatic fluid, this would be news to me. Anyway, it took nearly a dozen minutes, and these were the longest 12 minutes ever, but I loosened the silver nitrate canister and finally, click, punctured it with a freshly grown claw, and the can went whoomp. And I immediately lost consciousness again as the silver nitrate filled the cabin. And that's the end of part 4. Wow, 7 minutes. All right. Get out your hymnals, my parishioners. We're going to read a couple more poems. I think we're on page 28 now. You ready? Get ready. All right, parishioners, what did I say? Page 28? Hey, there's another two poems. They're really short, these guys, so. Page 28 in the hymnal. All right, I in the interim, I put the link to the Amazon into my notes so I can copy it into the show notes so you guys can get an opportunity to buy your hymnals. So, don't say that you don't know where to find the link, because I freaking put it in to the show notes for this episode, St. Patrick's Day, 17. Anyway, so slip yourself over to page 28 and flip it open. Melanie Hope, and the thing is called Inside Your Silent Arms. And I probably read it before, but I'm going to read it again. The next one is going to be called I Offer You Persimmons from Elizabeth Randolph, and it's in almost like a little persimmon shape, I guess. And I probably definitely read that one before. And you know what? I'm not sure I care. There's a little bit of redundancy everywhere. Melanie Hope, Inside Your Silent Arms, page 28. Dreams bite my ears. I pretend it is you, whispering and nibbling and holding me. And I can twist and I can turn, and you cannot let go, but the dreams still bite me. I hear you whispering, it is okay. We will be together for the rest of the night, oh, and the rest of the day, and the rest of the world won't at all matter. I need only feel your breath upon me, in, around my ear, the dream of the rest. I want to forget all the empty past, oh, nights when I dreamt hollow, woke screaming, times too many dreams collided in me, and the television would not turn off. That wasn't so bad. Maybe they get better as you get closer to the beginning. The next one's Elizabeth Randolph, I Offer You Persimmons. This persimmon is my mouth, offered like tea leaves, to be read, or tarot cards, lined palms, pure, immutable longing, just beneath the skin, traces of desire like fingerprints, bloodstains, DNA. I want to make this offering to you, pure, unblemished fruit, arcing, swollen with silent prayer, soundless adoration, silent golden fruit sliced to take between your lips, that hallowed place I've yet to find. Ooh la la. Ooh. We're going back more than one page next time. A preview. Okay, back to Macmillan, you guys. Alright, so Macmillan the Magician, we're back from our little congregation. Okay, that metaphor is just fucked. Alright, so here we are, Macmillan the Magician, chapter 8, part 5 is called Wreckage. I woke up later surrounded by hot gray ash covered and still burning debris and wreckage. My eyes, nose, and throat were burning from smoke, ash, and probably my silver nitrate aerosol. Excuse me. The hell's wrong with me? Anyway, sorry. My eyes, nose, and throat were burning from smoke and ash and probably my silver nitrate aerosol. I gagged, coughed, spat. I couldn't even open my eyes, which were involuntarily and painfully closed quite tightly. When I could, ever so briefly, peek through, I found myself still restrained, but the black cables, which were actually tubes for the milking of my lymphatic fluid, were melted or broken off or yanked out of my body by force. I struggled mutely and not mutely. Gah! Son of a! I struggled and struggled and struggled and swore. This easily lasted another couple dozen minutes. I heard a kind of chunk behind me as something or other burst into flames. Finally, I felt a sudden crushing pressure and intense heat and lost consciousness again. There's a part break. The next thing I was aware of, I was on my back. A smoldering wreckage was several meters away. My arms and legs weren't bound and there was no sign of the black cables. I felt very weak. Likely because I'd been blown up. I could feel my entire body regenerating and it felt warm and cool at the same time. Nearby, someone was moving. I tilted my head as much as possible and saw, to my surprise and joy, Butch. He was guarding my body with one of our huge rifles. Butch, I said weakly, a breathless whisper, though I'd been trying to shout. Tis Min. You are alive. You are awake. Yes, he was like a Mark I human being, but he thought if he took my blood or whatever fluids, he would live forever. Butch let me talk, but as I write these words, I'm aware he didn't know who he is. The smoke from the nearby wreckage was triggering my nictitating membranes, but I was feeling much better, even exhilarated. I turned and got to my feet. Butch, I said, do you have anything for me to wear? He disappeared into some bushes and reemerged with a pale blue jumpsuit. He tossed it at me and I put it on. I briefly explained to Butch what had happened, my seeing the shuttle land, Blake's reaction to my pheromones, and his iguana urine-smelling handkerchief, the static, she put quotes, the so-called static neutralizer, and my waking in the shuttle. I told Butch I wanted to examine the wreckage and make sure that kidnapper person was good and dead. He nodded with chin and rifle.
It's a part break.
She says, back to the text, sorry. The wreckage was still smoldering, and I carefully walked into this jagged, ash-covered, popping and sighing hell. I saw nothing to help me learn anything, but carefully picked my way back to the bench where I must have been tied. That last explosion really reduced the shuttle down to a flat jumble of homogeneous, dull gray stone and metal and melted debris. I moved a large, hot metal, she put quotes, she put a question mark. I moved a large hot metal plate and realized beneath my foot was something soft and wet, and bent down to get a better look. And whatever it was, it moved under my foot, and it was Blake, and he stood up, reanimated now that his naked flesh had come into contact with my bare foot. I'd nearly lost my balance. He grabbed me immediately upon seeing me, but I leaned toward him, pressing a thumb under his chin, stabbing through with the talon into the soft tissue and through it. I gassed him as I had after our disgusting evening and lifted him with my other arm. I threw him back in the direction from which I had come with all my strength. He landed on agile toes and took maybe one step, maybe half a step back in my direction. Butch, rifle at the ready, shot him several times. Vampire, he said, kicking the corpse, flipping it over. He knelt and checked for life signs. You don't know, I blurted. You don't know the half of it. He returned to poking around in the wreckage. Oh, I'm sorry, she said. I returned to poking around in the wreckage as Butch dragged the body off to incinerate it. The hell's wrong with me? Sorry, you guys. So, and Butch drags the body off to incinerate it. Again, I found nothing of use. Nothing. None of my gear or armor, and nothing recognizable, and certainly nothing useful from Blake's possessions. Whatever he is, wherever he's from, would remain, for the time being, a small mystery, though I had asked Butch to preserve a sample of Blake's biomatter. I decided to return and deactivate the birdhide, and that would be a long, long trek through the easternmost section of the bubble event, but I really had no idea where we even were. Fortunately, Blake didn't manage to carry my body outside the rift. It likely would have disintegrated me, like it did the imp, to do so. As I've said, I had no idea where we were. There were mountains nearby, and as I certainly hadn't left the Molesundmus, that's just the words bubble and event is Estonian, I think. She says she probably hasn't left the bubble event. That was most likely north. She says that the mountains are almost always in the north if you're in the bubble thing. Fortunately, Butch did know, and he briefed me. We were south of the Wolf, the mountain range I'd eventually call home, yet far, far from West Covina. Well, yeah, if you're on foot. north and a bit east, to be clear, where our surveillance station and the Imp's underground dungeon were located. I felt like I could use a walk, and Butch accompanied me, although this wasn't, strictly speaking, necessary. We struck off heading due south, the sun ahead, but to the right, indicating early afternoon. On our walk, I found myself falling behind, spacing out, and even spontaneously mumbling angry missives concerning my recent encounter. Butch became more and more attentive and sympathetic as the hours and kilometers passed. About halfway, we walked near enough a second crater, which at the time neither of us gave a second thought to, but then after another hour or two, we encountered a third crater, and after about an hour again, a fourth. A few hours before sunset, we reached the original crater and our surveillance station. There was a chill in the air. As Butch began dismantling the surveillance station, I returned to the shadows where I busied myself digging up the egg sac and torturing the nearly hatched pulsating eggs. Nutripack and all. I may have cried were that a thing I could do. Fuck that guy, I grumbled, sadly, angrily, as I rejoined Butch, when, briefly, I rubbed the back of my own neck, then worked with Butch in silence. And that is the end of part five, or whatever part. It's part five. That's the end of the chapter two. Yeah, that's the end of part five and the end of chapter eight. And honestly, I am very proud of myself. I don't know. You guys, I guess I'm just my own fan, but putting chapter seven and chapter eight together and the upcoming chapter nine, mwah. Me personally, I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Anyway, open your hymnals to page 24. We're going to read a pretty long one. I think there's actually two. Anyway, I'll be back in a minute. Less than a minute. Alright, parishioners, let's open our hymnals for the last time this week, and we'll do it some justice in these last few minutes before I thank everyone for listening and whatnot. Alright, page 24, the key to everything. Alright, find the link in the show notes. I'm not kidding about this. You know, order yourself one of these tiny little suckers. This one's from Terry Wolverton. See, everybody has a cooler name than me. It's called Black Slip. Once again, page 24. She told me she had always fantasized about a woman in a black slip. It had to do with Elizabeth Taylor in Butterfield 8. She came to my house with a huge box gift wrapped with gigantic ribbons. Inside a black slip, slinky with lace across the bodice. She told me how she was embarrassed in the department store, a woman in men's pants buying a black slip clearly not intended for herself, and about the gay men in line behind her, sharing the joke. She asked me to try it on. I took it to the bathroom, slipped it over my head. I stared at myself for a long time before I came out of the bathroom. Walked over to her lying on the bed. That was the first time. It got easier. The black slip was joined by a blue slip, then a red one, and a long lavender negligee, the black slit to there. I wore them to bed. In the morning she would smile and say how much she loved waking up next to a woman in a slip. The black slip remained our favorite. We always made love when I wore the black slip. Once I showed up at her door late at night, wearing a long coat with only the black slip underneath. One night I cooked dinner at her apartment, wearing nothing but the black slip and red suede high heels. It was always the first thing to pack when we went on vacation, and she used to make me promise that if we ever broke up, I'd never wear that slip for anyone else. I don't know where it is now. Stripped of that private skin when we broke up, I never went back to claim it. I think she must have packed it, given it, thrown it away. On bad days, I imagine her sliding it over the head of some new love, whispering about Elizabeth Taylor, and waking up to a woman in a slip, or perhaps it's still there, draped on the back of the door, a sinuous shadow, a moan in the dark. Okay, that one was really good. All right, the next one's on page 27, parishioners, so get your open, move over. Flip your books. It's from Eileen Miles, and it's called Porn Poems, and it's 1, 2, 3, 5 lines just. Her tongue and her heart were throbbing in the holster of her pussy. That's like the kind of crap I would write. All right. Well, the only thing left is the little outro where I thank everyone for listening and subscribing, and I thank Jennifer, so I guess we'll do that now. Anyway, happy St. Patrick's Day, parishioners. Alright, well, that was a long one, no? Chapter 8, a bunch of lesbian stuff, Jennifer Morency and her WTF comedy / politics / journalism. I don't know anything. Thank you, Jennifer. Alright, well, I hope you're enjoying the sneak peek at Macmillan the Magician novel. If you like it a lot, I highly recommend that you check out my Amazon page. It'll be in the show notes. And you'll find a actual novel called Tisman, The Last Blade Hunter, which personally I think is better. But maybe that's just because it's actually finished. Also, the narrator does a much better job hiding herself in that novel. All right, let me see. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you, Jennifer Morency, for the intro, which I keep recycling, and for your WTF submission. Don't forget to tip your barista. Subscribe to the newsletter. The mic is closed. You guys, you might want to submit next time. I'll throw all the submissions toward the front. Toward the intro, the beginning, so that you guys can just skip out the end, since I pretty much just write this and then record it for my own purposes. All right. Well, this has been chapter 17. This has been episode 17. St. Patrick's Day. We still haven't compiled the bonus episode for The Key to Everything, but there were some lesbian poetry in here. Hey, good night. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Enjoy your green beer. Kiss me, I'm Irish. This place is dangerous. I am reality's whore. Okay.
I am reality's whore!